All right, we're live. Welcome back. So Greg and Paul show. I'm Gregory.
I'm Paul.
And we break down the latest in startups, SaaS, AI, whatever the internet is debating. Paul, where are you dialing in from?
I am dialing from New York, Brooklyn specifically. I'm sitting outside of a cafe.
We asked him to step away from the espresso machine that was hurting my ears. And this week we have a guest, Tushar Kumar.
Hey guys.
He is a financial professional I've known for some time. We'll conduct a little interview with him, and of course we'll always touch on some news items. Tushar, you want me to do a little intro for you and help audience understand your background? And well, here you go. I wrote up this nice intro for you.
Let's do that.
I'm more excited than ever to read. So Tushar Kumar is a private wealth advisor and co-founder of Twin Peaks Wealth Advisors. He helps tech professionals navigate the complexities of equity compensation, tax strategy, and long-term wealth preservation. With over 15 years of experience guiding executives, founders, and employees through IPOs, acquisitions, and concentrated stock positions, he takes a strategy-first, relationship-driven approach to financial planning. UC Berkeley graduate. I love Berkeley. I've lived there for many years. Tushar specializes in aligning investments with personal values, helping clients plan for major milestones from stepping away to their 9-to-5 and building a legacy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Greg. That's a very flattering introduction. I appreciate you having me.
No, it's super fun.
I didn't realize that you lived in Berkeley. That's cool.
I lived in Berkeley for 7 years. I loved it.
Okay.
My wife went to Berkeley. I went to Berkeley. Berkeley somewhere like, God, when I was like 18, I spent like the summer there. I've always loved that town. And when we lived in San Francisco, my wife kept getting me to try to move there, and eventually she won that. So we were there for many years. It's a beautiful place.
Hey, those were really four fun years of my life. And we met through Arjun, who also went to Berkeley. So give him a shout
Berkeley,
out.
Berkeley connection. All right. So, since we have you today and you've got some really interesting experience, I think would be relevant to all the tech professionals and particularly founders who tune into us. I prepared some fun questions for you. So why don't we start with like you telling us about your entrepreneurial journey? You know, I know that I've heard your story. I think it's an awesome story. So I'd love for you to like tell us about how you got started and came to, I'm gonna reveal the $500 million in AUM that you recently announced, which is a fantastic milestone, but I know it didn't happen overnight. So tell us about that.
Yeah, it didn't happen overnight, and you know, the credit goes to the team for helping us get to where we are. But maybe what I'll do is I'll take a step back and explain why I'm doing this in the first place. And you know, my first experience with a financial advisor was when I was 14 years old. So my dad unfortunately got diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer in March of 2021. He passed in about 8 months later, and he was the primary breadwinner. He was the guy who really made all of the financial decisions in the household. But prior to his passing, he helped my mom hire a financial advisor, and that gentleman was with us for the better part of 20 years thereafter. And he came to us at this really pivotal moment in our lives where we didn't have a whole lot of clarity on what life was going to look like. My mom had a ton of questions like, you know, can I afford to send my twin boys to college? Will they need loans? You know, am I going to be able to retire here in the Bay Area? And he took us from this point of not really having any clarity to having a ton of clarity and a very clear action plan to work on. So I saw at a very young age the benefits of having someone in your corner in that capacity. So that's sort of what drives us. We want to move people from a point of clarity, from a point of confusion to clarity. And that's really ultimately why we got into this business. But I will touch on the founder journey and how this all started. So Vishal, my twin brother, and I, we both graduated from Berkeley, and we started in financial services right after graduating. We were with a much larger company at the time, but we were very much like pounding the pavement, and you know, we would try anything and everything to get clients, from working our Berkeley networks to cold calling, webinars, seminars, events, you name it, like we tried it. And you know, at the beginning, like most founders can relate to, there was a ton of rejection at first. I mean, we were battling a number of things, from how young we were to not really understanding sales to navigating the financial crisis, which had just happened. We graduated Berkeley in 2009. It wasn't the time, at that time, people weren't really excited about investing in the stock market. So there were a lot of headwinds that we dealt with.
No, I love the story. And like, it was all in the Bay Area, right?
At that time, yeah, it was almost all exclusively Bay Area clients. I mean, now we have clients across the country and some international,
yeah,
as well.
And like, it's a difficult industry. Like I've run into a lot of people who have tried to make it in wealth advisement and being an IRA, and it's tough. Like the beginning is really hard. You know, tell us more about some of the challenges. I remember some of the funny stories that you've told me about, like how you got some of your first customers.
Yeah, I mean, looking back at those days, it's like the most fun I never want to have again. but there was a ton of like learning moments there too. So we would do funny things to sort of just keep ourselves like engaged. So I remember this one time, my brother Vishal was at the desk, and he's like, "Okay, I'm gonna cold call today." I was like, "Okay, cool. Who are you gonna call?" Like, we were calling a lot of Cisco employees at the time. And he's like, "You know what? Instead of going for a specific company, I'm just gonna pick a random Indian name. And I'm gonna go on LinkedIn and find everyone with that name in the Bay Area who is an engineer and call that person." So I think that day the name was Kishore. I'm gonna call every Kishore that I can find. And so, you know, and then we book a bunch of meetings with Kishores and land Kishores as clients.
And it worked as a method, as an approach.
It kind of worked. We have a few Kishores.
Yeah. I love it. Cause like, you know, this is a common challenge I hear from like almost every founder I meet with, right, is like the beginning's tough. There's a lot of legwork, and they have to like do outreach. They have to do cold calling. They have to like really struggle to get customers. No matter how great the product is, usually in the early days, there's still a lot of like just effort required to get people in the program. So I think people always love [S2] Absolutely. [S1] Love hearing about that.
And it never really goes away. Like we still deal with a lot of rejection on a very regular basis. And I think that's just the part of building any business. Now, I will say, having done this for 16 years, business does come a little bit more easily now than it did 16 years ago, because we have clients and they refer their friends, and they, you know, we have accountants that send us business. So it does come more easily than it used to, but I mean, there's still a ton of rejection every day.
And it's still just as challenging to deal with.
It's a different kind of challenge, but yeah.
All right. So that's interesting in terms of like building the business, but like now that you have customers, and you have some experience, what I'd love to ask you about is, you know, what you recommend to, let's say, founders or people that have a lot of their net worth tied up in a company. Like most founders I know, that's usually like by far their largest asset, equity holding. That's all of their, sure, their net worth. So how do you recommend? Yeah, but Ball's one of those people. So what do you recommend to those people? And obviously there's probably different stages and different approaches. So I'd love to just hear, you know, your thoughts on that topic.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And you kind of nailed it right there. But so I'd say it really depends on where that individual is and what their circumstances are like. But what I have found is that the stage that their company is at is going to dictate a lot of the strategies that we speak with them about. So for example, for early stage founders or early stage employees, typically the conversations that we're having are around things like QSBS or early exercising your stock options, chances are when a company is that early, there may not be a ton of liquidity planning or tax planning to really think about at that point. But those are some of the topics we'll cover at the early stages. As the company grows, the focus then shifts to, you know, additional stock option exercises, AMT tax liability. Later on, once the company is much more mature, then we're going to start talking to them about things like how do you navigate a potential tender offer or an acquisition or an IPO, and how do you best position yourself to, you know, make the most of that wealth event. So the way that I help someone who is at Stripe, which is a very mature private company that has somewhat regular tender offers, is very different from how I would advise someone who just raised their Series A.
Yeah. I know the tax part is what gets everybody, right? I've been through a tender offer. It was funny, like a lot of employees were very excited about it. And then when they saw what the tax implications were, they were a lot less excited.
Yeah.
It was pretty funny. It went from like thinking like I'm gonna have a down payment on a house to like I'm gonna have maybe a down payment to buy a Honda. Like, I literally,
it can be really shocking, and I don't think that everyone fully understands or appreciates the differences between like ISOs and NSOs and what that actually means, or double trigger events. Right? There's a lot of nuances to tech equity that you need to sort of think through to ultimately know what you're gonna have. But I will say, I mean, there's actually two things that I recommend just about everyone does at any stage of the startup journey. So the first thing is to actually establish an estate plan. It has nothing to do with the options or you know the liquidity event immediately. But I think just having a good estate plan in place with your trust, wills, power of attorney, healthcare directives, that stuff can really prove invaluable. And I think it's particularly relevant for founders and early stage employees because they often have this very large illiquid asset that's going to be illiquid for potentially a very, very long time. So, you know, having that asset point to a trust or having a clear plan for what happens with that wealth if that liquidity event happens after the person has passed away is important to think about. And the second thing I advise just about every startup employee is to partner with a knowledgeable CPA, because there's certain tax planning things they can take advantage of while the company is still private around like option exercises and whatnot. And, they'll need, I think, the services of a CPA before they would need my services.
Yeah, 100%. You know, a friend of mine got into wealth management and he became my advisor. I think it was one of his first customers. And so it was funny, like some of the advice that he gave me was exactly that. I remember one of the things he was talking to me about was like, do you have insurance? Do you have life insurance? Like, you guys own this condo. Like, what happens if like you're not around? I was like, these are good things to think about. Yeah, like I hadn't thought about that at all, right? And that was actually one of the first things that we did, right? Like if like, you know, my wife and I want her to be able to afford the mortgage, right? Like if I'm not around, right? Some basic stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Contingency planning is very important. You may not want to think about it, but you know, those contingency plans might end up being the most valuable thing that you do.
No, I do not like thinking about it.
for somebody that doesn't currently have a wealth advisor, how do you recommend them to start? Like, what's the first stepping process?
The first step is actually just to figure out your why. Like, why is it that you might want guidance in the first place, right? Is it time? Is it expertise? Is it accountability? Is it knowledge? You know, what is it that you're looking for? Because depending on that need, it might point you to different solutions. Maybe all you really need is a CPA. Maybe you need someone who can just help you with some basic cash flow planning. Or maybe you get to a point where your needs are robust enough that you need more of a full service wealth management firm. I think starting with why is always the first step, because that will help guide your search in the right direction.
All right. Why don't we move on? This is a question that I love to ask lots of people. So, and there's different flavors of it, but you know, what do you think is the biggest myth that people, let's say in the high tech space, believe about finance and wealth that you think needs to be debunked?
Sure. Well, I'll speak to one about like founders and early stage employees in particular, since I know that's your audience. But I'd say the biggest myth is when people think that they can worry about their financial planning after their exit. And that mindset can be very, very expensive. And waiting to plan for an exit typically means that you're acting, you know, you're acting reactively versus proactively, and it almost always costs you more in taxes. And I'll give you an example. So back when Twitter went public, I had a client there. She did not fully understand what exercising incentive stock options meant. And one of her coworkers said, hey, you should really exercise these options before the IPO. And she was about to do it. And then I opened her eyes to the fact that if she did, she may have an AMT liability around like $400,000 that she would have to pay out of pocket well before that stock was actually liquid. And she didn't have $400,000 just sitting in a bank account that she could use. And so anyway, we dodged that bullet. But yeah, planning, I think proactively planning would have certainly helped her. I think that exercise, had she done it a couple of years prior, would have been far less expensive. But yeah, definitely the biggest myth is to wait to plan. And I like to reference Bill Walsh, who was the 49ers coach. He would always script the first 20 or 25 plays of every game. And he was the first coach to do it, and now it's become commonplace. But he had not only those 20 or 25 plays planned, but he also had a number of contingency plans for those plays. So it allowed him to kind of dynamically navigate the game and have a game plan before it actually happened. So I think we can take a very similar approach to financial planning, and especially for early stage employees.
Yeah, I think a lot of people aren't aware that the tax implications are really complicated. And I'm not an expert. Like I've heard lots of stories like when you describe that, like if you exercise in this way, the implications are enormous in terms of taxes. And if you do a different way, it can have a different impact. And it's really complicated. So yeah, if anybody out there has questions, you should definitely do some research and perhaps seek a advisement of a professional, because it can get really complicated really fast.
Yeah, and I'll give some direction to your listeners here. But there's a firm in Southern California called Workwise CPAs. It's run by an accountant named Asma Hoke. She's great. She's very knowledgeable with stock option taxation. She does a lot of our planning for our clients. If you're looking for someone who's knowledgeable in that space on the tax side of things, consider her.
All right. So that's the exit scenarios that sure. People who listen and to our show perhaps are excited about. The other type of people who listen to the show, and the vast number of people I speak to are in a different position, which is usually, or maybe it's even the same person, but they work at a large tech firm. They are making a significant amount of money, but what they really want to do is start their own business, start their own startup. They're looking to build some type of technology product or do something. And so it'd sure. be great to hear from you, people in that position, right? So typically it's they work at a Microsoft or an Amazon or a Google, and they've been there for a few years and they're making great money, but they see themselves as I need to figure out some kind of plan around doing my own thing. So what would you recommend people do if they want to pursue their startup full time?
Yeah, I mean, there's really two ways to plan for that financially. So, and I come across this quite a bit within my own client base, but the first thing they can do is build guardrails. Or option two is to invest for cash flow. And I'll talk about each one. So building guardrails, what I mean by that is making sure that they have saved up enough liquid savings so that they give themselves real runway so that they're not going to be stressed about bills while they go and start their next thing, because that can put undue pressure on the person. I like to say, plan for a couple of years, because it might take some time for your startup to get off the ground. But having a couple of years worth of runway is going to allow you the time to work on a product, ideate it. If you have to go back to the drawing board, you have some time before you need to make a call on whether you continue. So guardrails can be really helpful. And in terms of effectuating that for clients of mine at places like Meta and Google, typically what we'll do is we'll have them sell some shares and park it in cash or money market so that they have that liquidity pool available to them. For the people who are looking to make that same switch, who maybe have more obligations, these are typically people who have families, maybe they have children, a mortgage, they're going to be a little bit more concerned about cash flow. So, you know, investing some of their funds in a way that actually generates monthly or quarterly or annual cash flow while they're not earning the same paycheck can be helpful. So examples of things that we've done there is we've said, hey, look, you've got, you know, X millions of dollars in Meta stock. Why don't we take some of that and invest it in different credit funds that are paying out, you know, X percent, and that gives you some monthly cash flow that you can use for your bills. So those are really the two primary ways that I've seen people address that challenge.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's, I think what I've seen is like people need to perhaps plan for it to take longer than they might think. I think that was the best part of what I heard you say. Everyone's always very optimistic, but the reality is like you don't know what's going to happen in the market, right? Like it might, like, because I've seen people like they're building this thing on the side and they're kind of working on it, and then like it takes off and they get really excited about it. But like it could be a false start. Something could happen in the marketplace. So not that you shouldn't like jump into it and like take advantage of the opportunity that's presented to you. Like that's fantastic that you've got traction and it's growing. Just be aware that like it might not happen in 3 months that you're just like able to replace your salary, or like maybe you even do that, but sometimes it's not sustainable, right? So just be careful and be smart and try to set yourself up.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. And you know, every overnight success took, you know, 10 years in the making. So I think things take a longer time than people think.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have a couple of people that are in this situation where they work full time and they're working on something. And so that's why like I talk to them a lot about this, like when should they leave their job, right? And so obviously like having the financial wherewithal to be able to support yourself for a given period of time, really important. And then have traction. Like I would try to like stay at my full-time job until you're like, wow, we're getting, you know, 10 signups a day now. We got 100 times this weekend. Like wait till you've got some traction. I think people maybe get a little too excited too early. And you want to make sure that like there's enough signals out there that indicate it could work.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. Awesome. So, you know, how about early stage founders who have had a small exit? Like, so similar situation to this, but like maybe they've sold their company, they've got some cash, or maybe it's equity, and they're thinking about their next startup. Like, how do you recommend that they like balance investing in their next venture and just diversifying away so that they can be to some degree financially secure?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And it's actually one that's coming up a little bit more often right now because of, you know, some of the VC funding that occurred in like 2020, 2021, when prices were very frothy. We're starting to see some exits from some of that, but they're not, you know, all that great yet because of the multiple that many investors paid back then. But in terms of like how to balance that, I think that you have to start with, of course, building a personal runway for yourself, right? That way you can work on your next big thing without financial anxiety. So I do think it makes sense to set some aside for yourself to make sure that you can, that you have the resources to kind of get by. But from there, I'm a big believer in reinvesting in yourself. So, you know, if you were to ask me like, what would I do in that situation? I would bet on myself and I would start the next thing, especially if what I've had is not enough to, you know, secure my financial future forever. I think reinvesting in myself through education, professional development, maybe starting a, you know, using the money as seed capital for a business, I would take that bet all day.
Yeah, no, I love it. I know so many people who do this. They just completely double down on the next startup. Like, I don't know if I would do that personally, but like I meet people all the time. Like they took basically everything they earned from their exit and put it into the next company, which I think is really admirable. And I love that they just have so much confidence that it's gonna work.
Well, the mindset there too is that you're not starting from zero when you start the second time around, right? You're starting from this huge knowledge base and experience base that you have. That
network, experience.
The relationship.
That's right.
A little loud there, dude. That's okay. So I have another follow-up question that's related to this. Like, I think people also want to get into angel investing, and it's something you and I have talked a little bit about, but I'm curious, like, what your thoughts on that, right? Because I think the same scenario here, like, you had some kind of exit, there's, you have some cash now, or like successful tech executives who were very lucky and had a great run with like an Apple or a Google, they've got a lot of cash and they get approached all the time from people who perhaps want them to invest in a startup. So what are your thoughts on like angel investing, and what advice do you have for people who perhaps want to pursue that, like either on the side or even full time?
Yeah, well, maybe I'll share a couple of examples from what I've seen my own clients do. So many of my clients who have had some, you know, significant wealth events do like the idea of getting involved with angel investing, and they do it a few different ways, right? They may use an online platform like an AngelList or Equities and SharesPost or Forge, I think is what it's called now, to get exposure to some of these private companies. If they have relationships with founders, they can kind of go direct. But I'll speak to it from a financial planning standpoint, right? Because the odds of one of those investments, you know, turning out well is so low that I typically have my clients limit how much they actually invest in the first place, right? So it might be 1 or 2% of their liquid net worth is something that we would commit to angel invest in. And from there, and the way I think about it is, look, if we just assume that all of those investments go to zero, I think your financial plan is still going to be okay and on track. So I don't have a ton, you know, honestly, I don't have a ton of perspective on the doing angel investing full time, because I just haven't experienced that with my client base.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to speak about something that I haven't experienced firsthand.
No, that's fine. I think for everyone, like limiting a portion of your net worth and seeing it like as part of your portfolio is definitely the best advice. And you're correct too, that like, the math is well known, right? That like most, not just angel investments, but venture investments go to zero. Like that is just the reality of the space. I did meet with a couple of angel investors. There's some great networks here in Seattle. And Paul, I think you and I talked about it. And since we've hit on this topic, he had some good advice about like just making sure you make enough investments was his thoughts around it, was that people generally spend, they get all excited about it. It's like their cousin's startup or their friend, or let's assume that like you're this person who just had an exit, or you have some money and you work in tech company. And so you get approached by people all the time. And it's like a good friend or a college buddy or somebody, like you really believe in them, right? And you think they're doing something that's excellent. And they just double down on it. I don't think too much about like the long-term or portfolio perhaps implications, sure. Right? They just go like, here's 30 grand or here's 100 grand. Like they just make like a really large investment, where if they looked at it like, I've got X amount of dollars in my, like as my net worth, I'm gonna take 1%. So let's pick an easy number. Like it's 100 grand or 500 grand or $1 million. Right. And then mm-hmm. you just take that portion, that 100, that 500, that million, and then you divide that up on a number of investments and just think about it like from that perspective. And then he actually had a number, this guy, John Secrest, I can, if anyone's interested, I can provide a link to like courses and things that he does. He's considered like the grandfather of angel investing in Seattle. And his number was 20 investments. So he's like, if you're an individual person and you've got some cash and you want to do angel investing, he's like 20 is the number where the math will typically show, not guaranteed, that you'll have enough hits that'll it will return the investment. So if you spent that $1 million, you'll get the $1 million back. Or if you spent 100 grand, you get the 100 grand back. The way you spend 100 grand, you spend $5,000 per investment, and there's a whole bunch of ways to do it. But I think like most people go into this and they just don't make enough investments, because 20 is a lot, right? You have to meet with 20 just to do 20 deals. You have to meet with 20 people, 20 contracts, 20 negotiate. There's a lot going on.
Sure. And then,
that's assuming that they all close, right? You might have to meet with a lot more people. So
yeah, I mean, ultimately, what you're advocating for really is diversification, right? Is make enough bets. So you're you know, singing my song here. But I will say one thing that has changed in the last, just even the last 5 years, is that the accessibility to many of these early stage investments has really accelerated. So like even for our clients, we have a couple of different platforms that our clients can use to get access to really well-known venture funds. And you know, years ago, you would only be able to go to some of these names if you were willing to write a seven-figure check or maybe even an eight-figure check. Now, with these more investor-friendly structures and platforms that have been created to provide these access, we can get people into, you know, a venture fund with as little as $100,000 or $250,000, and all of it is done with just one fund, right? That fund is taking the money and going out there and meeting with the founders and deploying the capital for our clients. So it has become much easier for investors to get that diversification without having to do it all on their own.
Yeah, yeah. So that was basically his premise, which is very logical to me, that like you just need to make enough of them. I that's why I brought this up, because like I meet people in high tech all the time who are interested in making some investments. And I think that's where I would advocate for like people being more like, that's called sensible. I think like, I always like to think like, oh, I know exactly what startups are gonna work. And I point to like all these founders, people I met that were a success, right? But I think that that's like just overconfidence, and it's, which is fine. I think that's what you have to be successful in the space, right? So trying to have some just a realistic perspective on like the realities of this, because there's so many things that can still go wrong, even if you got it right. Like you found the right startup, you found the right founder, you made the right investment, things can still go off the rails. The investment could just go to zero because the acquisition later down the road doesn't work, or they take on additional money and you get crushed. There's just so many things that can happen.
That's right.
All right. One more on this like similar topic. So, and I think the last scenario that we haven't discussed is like you're a founder and you're preparing for acquisition. Let's assume it's an acquisition.
Sure.
Because I think that's pretty common. IPOs are pretty rare, and they're not listening to our show on a Friday if they're prepared for an IPO. Maybe they are listening, but I think they've got plenty of help. If you're like aiming to get, or you're looking into the acquisition side, preparing for an acquisition, you think that's in the cards for you. Like, what kind of things should people do to enable that they have success, or set themselves up for success with an acquisition if they're running a startup?
Sure. So I'd say there's really five things to consider, right? The first is to build an option exercise plan and to understand the tax liability associated with that option exercise plan. Two, I think you should have a clear definition of like what enough looks like for you. And I'll speak to that in a second. Three, hire a CPA. Four, get your estate planning documents in order. And five, meet with a financial advisor to plan out what you're going to do with that money after the acquisition. But let me delve into each of these bullet points in a little bit more detail. So understanding your option exercise plan, right? So typically what I'll see with early stage employees is that they have incentive stock options. If they exercise and then hold those shares for a full year before the ultimate exit, you get more favorable tax treatment, right? So that does require some planning and some visibility, right? You can't decide you're going to go through an acquisition tomorrow and then get that same tax treatment. So you need to be a little bit proactive about this. Understanding the associated tax liability is key, because whether they're ISOs or NSOs, they're going to be taxed differently. So that's where I think partnering with a good CPA will make sense. Two, defining what enough looks like. So the reason I stress this is because when you're going into it, let's say you're the founder, right? And you have a lot of control over that sale. Knowing what enough is for you may help you negotiate that deal in a way that might be more favorable to you long-term. So for example, let's say you realize in your head that, hey, I really want to have $10 million of cash coming out of this deal. And you know that that's what your family needs to be comfortable. But the deal is worth $20 million. Do you really need to get all $20 million in cash, or should you maybe negotiate some stock in that deal so that you have stock in the new entity that you'll be working for after the deal goes through? So understanding what enough means to you can help you pull the right levers to make sense of the deal. Third, I mentioned hire a CPA. I think that's self-explanatory. Four, estate planning documents. We did talk about that a little bit earlier, so I won't go into it. And then lastly, to meet with an advisor to plan what you're going to do with the cash when it comes in. And I think there the conversation really needs to be around, like, what do you want that wealth to accomplish for you? Is that giving you financial freedom? Are you looking to reinvest that because you really want to grow your wealth? Are you looking to generate passive income so you can take some more time off and enjoy your life? But all of those qualitative goals are going to ultimately drive the quantitative strategy.
Anyone listening to this show is going to gamble it all on their next startup.
believe it.
Or crypto again.
Crypto, yeah. Stable coins is acceptable, yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. Well, that was awesome. Paul, are you free to chat with us, or are you still
in this machine? I'm learning so much.
Oh, that's bad. I get a little sound, but that sounds good. You sound better. So why don't we move on and do some news items? In fact, like, I think there's only one news item to talk about this week. Are you ready for this, Paul?
I am.
So, and Tushar, we talked about it too, like the MIT report. So this MIT report came out that said 95% of generative AI pilots at companies or Fortune 500 companies are failing. And it was widely reported and reposted and joked about on LinkedIn and Twitter. And so I obviously have a perspective on it, but like, what do you guys think about this report? Tushar, why don't we start with you since you're our guest?
Sure. I think there was a chart right on this, Greg, where it showed the data around like why the companies are failing. And it was, I believe it was like around adoption or wanting to use the technology in the first place.
100%. Yeah. Here, let me show that. Do you have that? I got it.
Yeah. So
yeah, here's the chart.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So what does that bottom one say? I can't really read it.
That one says unwillingness to adopt new tools.
Yeah. So I think this is where we have to mesh kind of the human component with what's going on. I think simply having the tech isn't going to get us there. People need to have it in front of them. They need training on it. They need to understand why they need to use it. They need to understand how to use it. So there is a human element to effectuating change. And that's why large companies like Microsoft have whole orgs for change management, right? Is to get people to adopt and use new technology. But yeah, I'll let Paul chime in with his thoughts as well.
100% agree. I think people are right now just scared of it, scared of AI. And you can't adopt the tool that you're scared of.
So I think people, I agree with all of this. And I found this chart, and that's why I thought this was kind of funny, actually, that like, why are they failing? Well, the number one reason is because people are unwilling to adopt the tools. But why are people unwilling to adopt the tools? Because I think people are correctly concerned that there's a perception that I think is becoming a reality that AI is replacing some jobs. Do you guys agree with that? Or
I think, well, one, I think going back to the first thing is like, why aren't people using? I think just behavior change takes a very long, it just takes a very long time. I was actually just at a hotel in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, and I saw this elderly woman sitting with the concierge asking him about how to get a taxi to get to the airport and what time she should leave. And she wasn't leaving for a couple of days, but she was doing all this planning with the concierge, and he was printing stuff out and writing it. And I was like, she could just open an app and call an Uber and not even have to go through this whole process, right? But she's probably been taking cabs for the last 50 years and just wants to keep doing it that way.
Yes, so. I do think that that's a huge part of it, right? There's people who are still worried about the security issues, or like, I don't like the fact that ChatGPT is like logging all that stuff. I mean, that did come out too, that like, that was quite surprising. I thought that Altman revealed on that podcast that like, oh, if we ever get subpoena, like, or you get subpoena, like we might have to provide your ChatGPT history and discovery in lawsuits. Like, that actually had never occurred to me that like, oh my God, like everything I'm typing into ChatGPT might be something that gets used against me in a court of law. I was like, where's my anonymous GPT? Because that would be the one that I would prefer to. In fact, like if you listen carefully to like a lot of venture capitalists, particularly like Jason Calacanis, he's very clear that he uses like anonymous browsing tools and all kinds of things like that to prevent that type of thing from happening. Cause it just would be a mess. If like Jason Calacanis's search history not only got just used in court against him or used in court, but also just was made public, like all the things he's searching for. And like, it would just be terrible, right? No one would want that. No one would want that to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I completely agree. Yeah.
So I can see that. Good.
Do you think all of this sums up into people just scared to adopt this technology? And do you think at the flip side, it is pushing people away from their jobs?
I mean,
are people losing jobs because of AI?
I have an optimistic view on this. Like, I think that all technological innovation is inevitable, and the labor force continuously needs to retrain. I even think about the way I run my business today is so vastly different from how I ran it 16 years ago. I'm still in the same job, but you know, the amount of work that I have to do, the type of work I have to do has changed so dramatically over those 16 years. But you know, the same way that automobiles displaced horse-drawn transport employees, you know, but it also did create a bunch of like net new opportunities. I believe we're still in the very early innings of AI. So like right now, I think there's an early focus on things like efficiency and cost cutting and doing what we already know how to do more efficiently. But what about when we start to use AI to do things that we just weren't able to do before at all, right? And I think that AI is going to make every laborer out there much more productive. And I believe that the future is some kind of a mesh between AI and the human element. And I also can't help but think about what problems in the world we're going to be able to solve because of the increased efficiency and productivity for each person, right? And let's take, I'll kind of use an example that I've lived through, but let's take robots, right? People are very concerned that robots are going to take jobs from humans. And now we can see that actually probably is going to happen, right? But what about areas of our society where robots could drastically help, right? We have a huge shortage of care providers for the elderly. Could robots help there? Right now we have productive employees being taken out of the workforce to provide care for these people. You know, what if robots and AI could help bridge that gap, could keep those people in the workforce, keep those people happy and allowing them to live a life of meaning. So again, I have the optimistic take on it. I think there will of course be, you know, some retraining that's required, but I still think the future is bright.
Paul, what do you think?
I think I have a more pessimistic view on this. So what I see is that people are just don't tend to adopt new tools by themselves. It takes a drastic measure. Like the people's wielding the new tools completely out competing the old people, the older people that's not using these tools. And just because they're out competing in the workplace, they're forced to change.
Okay. So I don't know, you know, I'm of two minds with this. I like to be, and I like to think of myself as the optimistic person, you know, but I saw this report come out and I was like, God, they're all, you know, and there was a lot of people saying like, oh, the AI innovation's not real, like it's a bubble, all that stuff started to happen. And then I went to this Windsurf vibe coding meetup this week here in Seattle. And it was just eye-opening to me, like watching everybody in the room just vibe code stuff and create things that is just science fiction, like 2 years ago. Yeah. The idea that you could just turn this machine on and then you could just tell it, like, I literally told it, like, make me a Flappy Bird game. And it made me this game. And then I could tell it, like, change the color and do this. And it would just do all of that. It was like, it's just mind blowing. If you haven't gone to one of these things, I recommend everyone like go or like watch a video. It is unbelievable. So like what I woke up the next morning and I was like, the innovation is real. Like I saw that and it really helped like reiterate to me that the innovation is real. Maybe it's a bubble, maybe it's not. Maybe NVIDIA's overvalued. Like those are fair arguments. But you can't say that like it's not a revolutionary technology that has the potential to like just reshape everything. So from that perspective, I'm really optimistic. And I love that you brought up robots being used to like repair oil rigs in the ocean or clean up nuclear spills. Like I could just come up with hundreds of scenarios where like, robots are a way better option to do things that like we don't want humans to do or humans can't do. Right at Chernobyl, they had to like have those volunteers to go and like move stuff around, and all those guys died. Like it's just horrendous. Like what they had to do to clean it up, right? And now we would have like robots that could go and do that. We don't have to put people at risk. I think that's fantastic. But I do think that like, and I'll share this report. I do think that the AI tools and innovation taking jobs away is real. And so this was a study that came out. The article goes in to say like, it's not peer reviewed, there's issues with it, but we're seeing all these, you know, employment numbers that seem to indicate it's really hard to get a job as a college graduate, no matter where you graduated from, like a great school, a community college, it's really difficult. And that's something that, you know, we hadn't seen in the past. And then this study seems to indicate that at least some part of it is AI. I do think there's other factors. I think zero interest rate environment is huge, maybe 80% of it. You could make an argument for that. But I don't know. I think AI is having an impact today. And I know, Paul, you have a perspective on this.
Yeah, anecdotally. So I owned a dev agency before. And AI's effect on doing development work is just, it's massive. It cut the price overall of all of my projects in half. So, you know, what that means is you're just pushing people out of the market, right?
Yeah. So the work that you were getting now, like, so the way I understood what you were doing is like, you were literally creating an MVP. So a minimum viable product for a company. Exactly. It was easy for them and better for them to outsource it to someone like you. And I know other people had this business too, and they would build prototypes and do all kinds of research and things for companies. But now with like vibe coding tools, it's very easy for them to just do it internally, or like the product people are creating the MVPs themselves. They're not outsourcing these things to development teams to create them.
Exactly. Yeah, going back to your hackathon or Windsurf, where you vibe coded your game, it used to be a product where we would have to hire somebody like me or my team to do this for them. But now you can sit in front of your computer and just talk to AI. And it'll get it done. Yeah.
No, it's very real. I mean, we're seeing it. Even in my line of work, I'm seeing a lot more productivity per employee. There's like this huge trend in my industry where there's a ton of financial advisors who are going to be retiring over the next 10 to 15 years, and there's not enough of us coming in to fill that gap. So I'm constantly bombarded with these new AI tools for financial advisors, where I guess the ultimate vision here is that financial advisors are not going away, but perhaps one advisor is going to be able to serve more households more efficiently by using AI. And I'm already seeing that in a very small capacity in our business today. And I think that's, you know, maybe what that report is reflecting, is that the existing employees that are there are able to just do a whole lot more, and that's resulting in fewer jobs being created by those same companies. I will say there's going to be probably a latency effect to this, where those people who are out of work will ultimately be able to start new businesses and get started much more quickly because of AI as well. So there's two sides to it, but we're probably living through some of the early pain.
Yeah, I agree. That's why I tend to be a skeptic on the like AI taking all the jobs piece. It's logical that, college graduates and like entry level jobs would be the ones that corporations or just any company pulls back on, because those are things that AI can probably do. Like, that's what I did with interns, right? Like, do this research thing for me, or fill out all these forms, or take all these Excel sheets and mash them all together. And those are the types of things that AI could do really well. So I don't have like a huge need for interns to do that. And I think that companies are definitely seeing that. But I also think that like you had ZERP for like 14 years. Yeah. So, and I think that people don't actually talk enough about this. So you had 0% interest rates for a long time. So if you're in your like 30s, that's all you've actually known, is that interest rates were zero, borrowing costs were like really low. And what I saw in Silicon Valley, because I came there before all of that, was like the ability to like just easily fund startups. It was very apparent to me, created a very competitive market for labor. So because there was like so many startups, they all needed a head of content. They all needed a CMO. They all needed a CTO, right? And now that there's not as many startups getting funded, the need for like these positions just isn't quite as acute as it was. There was really like a shortage. Like I remember 2016, 17, 18, it was like companies were desperate. It was really hard to hire people. There was like, there's still like 1,000 unicorns, right? I mean, that's a lot of companies. Right. And there's probably like 500 of them are in the Bay Area, and they all needed to hire people, right? We're not minting unicorns at that rate, and we're not funding companies that are going to compete with them at the same level. So I think that that's a larger factor in like the cooling off of the tech job market. Mm-hmm. And then you have this like, you know, AI narrative. And so of course employees are like, well, I better figure this out, right? I better be productive, because like the labor market just isn't as constrained.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. It did came a little bit of shock for software developers. Sorry to cut you off. You know, we thought we were safe forever.
I mean, like, I remember, yeah, like software developers were just like, you know, like you couldn't hold on to them. They all had a new job every 9 months. The salaries were just like through the roof, for, and it went on for like a long time, right?
All through reserve, essentially.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, the vibe coding stuff is real too. That's why, like, I started with that. And like, I think the innovation is fantastic, but you also have just a lot of other factors at play. Paul, we got this last piece, the swarm of AI agents. Did you want to take us through this one?
Yeah, sure. Just to talk through about it, I think we raised a bunch of really good points, right? People need to adopt these new tools. And I think we're so early in the process where people are not actually understand how we're using the tools correctly. So AI agents is a pivot away from these types of deep focused dev work. We're pivoting to your orchestration, you're doing systematic work, you're controlling multiple agents. So I'm really happy to see people understanding more and more about how to actually leverage AI and maybe it'll demystify and make it less scary for people to use them.
Yeah, so with this article, I mean, you and I were chatting about this last night, like, is this an example of like the massive efficiency that AI is bringing to, let's say, the engineering side?
Absolutely. So I'll just kind of like give you a detail on how developers work, right? We used to do one ticket or one fixes or one feature at a time, right? Because we have to essentially report up to our managers, be like, hey, today I'm working on this one thing. But now people are doing different things at the same time, all at once.
Yeah, so with AI agents, you can literally have a team of agents going doing all kinds of different tasks at the same time.
Maybe that's the new way that software gets developed, is instead of doing one sequential thing at a time, now you're doing multiple things and trying to package them together into a fully functional product.
Yeah, the example that someone gave me, and I'll see if you you agree with this one, Paul, is that security patches, that you could have like multiple agents now. So it used to be manual. It used to be manual in the sense that they'd have to find the security flaw, then they'd have to like either get the patch or write the patch. It was like this manual job of like hunting them down and then patching them and like get teams of people. Now you can like literally have agents find all of the flaws, either find the correct patch or write the patch themselves, and then even QA it to make sure that it's installed correctly. Because the old method was like, you had a developer sit there and just kind of approve them, make sure they're done correctly. Now you can even have AI do that, right? So you, like, massive efficiency 100%. And like just keeping code bases up to date and secure with agents working in parallel and just doing all of this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So like you can have trigger points where a security patch comes out or a security announcement comes out. The AI agents just picks that up completely by themselves. And the human in the loop would just be validating that this happened, right? To log it, to sign off on it, and then off you go.
All right. So let's end on this. We always do our meme of the week. And so I'm curious what Tushar thinks of this one. This is a tweet I wrote last year. So new jobs AI will create in 2025. I know which one I'm aiming for. Meme Lord in Chief, Data Wrangler Extraordinaire, Prompt Sorcerer, Artisan Synthetic Content Creator, Reality Whisperer, Deepfake Detective, Automation Overlord, Pixel Polisher, Data Whisperer. And then I love this one. Don't worry, Reply Guys will still be around.
A few of them is already true, especially the Meme Lord.
Yeah, we've seen that. Like, we've talked about that a lot on the show, that like startups now, distribution and getting traction is so hard that a founding creator or hiring an influencer is becoming a bigger and bigger thing, even in verticals or areas where that's not traditionally something that people think about, right? Like most people think about creators and influencers like on TikTok doing dances, but every industry now has multiple people who have followings and are like doing all kinds of things when it comes to different technologies, verticals, industries, whatever it is. And so remember we had that one with the girl who was doing all of the TikToks about the, what was that? It was like an AI content creation platform. There's also that T app that like was notable in terms of that it got hacked, but that one too scaled really quickly because they hired a dating influencer to help drive a lot of interest in that dating app, right? So this meme lord in chief, this idea that like creators and people that do lots of online memes is now like a real job description, I think has become a reality.
I think so. I'm seeing it even in the, you know, the boring industries like financial services and accounting and people are, I mean, it's, you know, I do it myself now. I'm writing content every week, sometimes more often than that. So yeah, that's here to stay.
Yeah. I think we'll end on a happy note. Cause like, I ultimately am optimistic and I do think that like people who embrace the new technology and willing to kind of roll with the punches to some degree too, right? You can't control everything, but if you figure these tools out and you figure out how to take advantage of them, that new roles will pop up. And I think it was ridiculous a couple of years ago to think that like a professional content creator creating memes around, you know, marketing tools was going to be a job, is now a reality.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right. Well, any final comments?
Hey, I just wanted to thank you guys for bringing me on here and got to spend an hour with you both. So I appreciate the time and I know this won't be the last.
Yeah, thank you so much. That was excellent. Paul, enjoy.
Apologies for the noise.
Yeah. As I say, enjoy your trip to New York. You're filming your video today, right?
That's already done.
Oh, you finished.
I'm hoping to share with the world in a couple of weeks.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. And we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thank you so very much.